One of the things that I love most about doing these podcasts is when I go into recording about a topic that I'm not wildly enthusiastic about. Maybe it's something that I know will be of interest to someone out there in Vetland, but it's not overtly relevant to me and my working life. Like, as an emergency vet, if you don't have a problem that's really bothering you right now and that I can make much better in the next, say, 24 hours, then I'm not that interested. So, palliative care, I'm sure it's good for some, but not my circus, not my monkeys, right? Or so I thought, until we were about 10 or 15 minutes into this conversation, when I realized that this could be one of the most important conversations we've had on here. For me personally, in my clinical working life, and probably also for you, your patients and your clients. First off, I realized I didn't really understand what palliative care means. If you, like me, think that it's kind of just delaying the inevitable as humanely as possible, not true. There's much more to it. Dr. Shea explains how, including differentiating palliative care from hospice care. Also, I would have said that emergency and critical care and palliative care are like the opposite ends of the care spectrum. Also not true. And if you work in ECC, you'll understand why I say that once you've listened to this. So, veterinary palliative care, you have yourself one more enthusiast in me. And I suspect there'll be a few more of you who will have some serious light bulb moments once this goes live. So who is Shay and who is Dave? If you're a regular listener, you'll know that Dr. Dave Collins is a prolific contributor to our clinical podcasts. And I'm thrilled to have him as a co-host for this episode. Dave is a registered specialist in small animal internal medicine at Northside Veterinary Specialist in Sydney, and also the founder and director at Vets on Tour, possibly the most fun vet conference company in the world, which we'll tell you about later. And it's because of Dave's snow conferences that we get to speak to Dr. Shea. Shea is going to be one of the key speakers at one of the upcoming Vets on Tour events. And because Dave has been chatting to her about her topics and what she's doing in the field of palliative care, he called me one day and said, "You need to get Shea on the podcast. She's awesome, and a lot of people will be interested in her work." And he was right. Besides being awesome, Dr. Shea Cox is also a global leader and subject matter expert in veterinary hospice and palliative care. She's certified as a pain practitioner, as well as in hospice and palliative care, and in pet loss. With her focus on technology, innovation, and education, her efforts are changing the end-of-life landscape in veterinary medicine. In addition to launching the first hospice and palliative care service integrated with a specialty hospital setting in 2012, she was also the first to launch a nationwide telehealth platform dedicated to quality of life and end-of-life support in 2017. In 2020, Pet Hospice was acquired by Blue Pearl Specialty and Emergency Pet Hospitals, and these days Shay and her team are leading the expansion of specialty level in-home pain management, hospice and palliative care, and end-of-life services across the United States. Shay believes that palliative care for pets should become more common and less scary for us GP vets. And after listening to this, I'm sure that you will agree. In this episode, Dr. Shay introduces us to and helps us differentiate the concepts of hospice and palliative care to improve the quality of life for pets with both curative and non-curative conditions. We untangle some common misconceptions regarding these care options, as Shay talks us through her career journey from starving art student to palliative care vet. She shares some resources and tools for end-of-life care management, such as quality of life scales. And we talk about the growing industry of in-home euthanasia and hospice practices, and about how you can integrate it into your work and your clinic. Of course, I ask Shay what it's like as a career. Like, doesn't it get depressing? Shay also challenges a few of our beliefs and our systems around what defines suffering, as well as end-of-life decision-making, and she shows us some new ways to think about some of the most important clinical decisions that we make almost every day in practice. As always, we also go down all sorts of rabbit holes, like figuring out your personalized goals, why those bleeding spleens have a third treatment option, how to leverage telemedicine to increase connection with your clients, and how cauliflower as your main source of nutrition can serve as a real motivator. Okay, Dr. Shea Cox and Dr. Dave Collins. Thank you so much for joining us on the Vet Vault.
Thank you.
And we have Dave. Dave Collins, Dr. Dave Collins, our specialist who we normally listen to on the clinical stream, is joining us as the co-host today. Why are you here talking to us about palliative care?
I was really keen to meet Shay, and as you know, we're planning an amazing conference in Wanaka where Shay is going to talk to us all about palliative care, and so I didn't want to miss the opportunity to hear about it firsthand.
Mm-hmm. I'm dying to learn about palliative care. It's something it's becoming a thing in the vet world for good reason, but it wasn't a thing when I started 20 years ago. But before we dig into that, let's start with our standard question of, Shay, once I was driving and I saw graffiti on the side of a building that said, bad decisions lead to good stories. And I thought made me think about whether that's true or not. So that's my opening line for the podcast. Do you agree with that? And if you do, do you have any examples to back that up?
I wholeheartedly agree with that. And with that question, the first thing that came to mind was bad decision, dropping out of school 3 months prior to graduation, buying a one-way ticket on a Greyhound bus to LA and not having a plan.
Wow.
The story can follow some other time.
So school meaning high school? Because I always get confused with American definition of what is school. Is that school or university?
University.
So vet, or what were you studying at the time?
So I always wanted to be a vet, and I ended up failing chemistry 3 times. So I ended up going to art school instead, something I could do. And about 3 months prior to graduation, I was like, what am I going to do with this degree? And had a little bit of a mini freak out, bought a ticket to LA one way on a bus that took about 4 days to get there, and just said, I'll figure it out when I get there. And I still remember to this day, that was 25 years ago or so, longer, 30 years ago, picking up my mom, picking up the phone. I was like, Mom, guess where I'm at? And she's like, where? I'm like, LA. She's like, what? When are you coming home? And I'm like, I don't think I am. So,
Wow. Bad decision. Did you ever go home?
For vet school, for veterinary school, I finally made it through. That's a whole nother story. That's part of the good outcomes from the bad decision. I ended up going back to Michigan where I was living at the time. But that lasted just through vet school. And then I was back to California.
And so what happened from there, Shay? You managed to get into vet school, obviously, and talk us through your journey.
Yeah. So when I landed in LA, it was, all right, now what am I going to do? So there wasn't a real high demand for ceramics was actually my profession.
Ceramic dropout.
Exactly. So ceramic flunky. And so I was like, what am I going to do? And when I was in art school back in Michigan, I worked as a home health aide. And so I was taking care of different families that had, I was going to say special needs, families that had special needs with their children and such. So I worked with patients with Alzheimer's, and I worked with a girl who had cerebral palsy, and just various nurse's aide type of roles like that. And I thought, well, maybe I could do that here in California. So I started working as a nurse's aide. And then I was like, well, maybe I could be a nurse. And to go to nursing school, you had to have chemistry, what I failed 3 times. And I was literally broke as a joke. I still remember at the end of the week having $1.18 in my bank account for groceries. So I would buy 2 heads of cauliflower, and that's what I would try to eat on. And I had scraped up $5 to buy a baby chemistry book from a school parking lot sale where they were selling used books. And there was a baby chemistry book there. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do this. And I just started self-studying. Something clicked. And I went to chemistry again after trying to self-teach it. And I passed. And I was like, hey, maybe I could do this vet school thing. And so went to nursing school.
On a strict cauliflower diet.
It's right on a strict cauliflower diet, $1.18. And so I got accepted to nursing school and then started taking prerequisites for vet school, and really went into the world of home health, hospice realm, and human medicine as a nurse. Went to vet school, went into ER. I was about in my 10th year of emergency medicine, and just felt the same things that were happening on the human side of medicine, where you just didn't have the time that you needed to really understand what was going on and to make a plan and to really get at the root of care. And I approached the owners of the specialty hospital where I worked and said, hey, I'd like to start a hospice and palliative care program here in the specialty hospital. Are you game for this? And they were really supportive. And that was 2012. And that's when I shifted back to my roots and started providing palliative care. And it's like, the rest is history.
Wow.
Can you talk us through, you seem to use the term hospice a lot in the US, whereas we're all familiar with palliative care over here. What is there sort of a difference? Or,
I mean, technically there is a difference. And this is one of the things I'm really excited to just speak with people about outside of the US and in New Zealand during the conference. But there's palliative care is an umbrella of care, and it's comfort care, no matter if it's curative or non-curative, and it can happen at any time during the course of the disease process. Hospice care is a specialized form of palliative care that's usually when there's a terminal diagnosis in the last 6 months of life. So there's a bit of a Venn diagram between the two. Here in the United States, most people say hospice care to mean end of life, palliative care, and hospice care. Whereas what I'm understanding, especially from Jackie, is palliative care, it's almost flip-flop. That is referring to the hospice component and comfort component. So it's, yes, so there is a different language. Curious, what does it mean to you guys when you hear hospice care or palliative care? What do you think?
I kind of thought it was the same thing. I thought it was just an American thing. I know from listening to American podcasts and that, I've heard the term hospice care there, but definitely the word palliative to me always sounded like palliative. Well, we're not going to fix this, so let's make you as comfortable. Let's palliate your discomfort while we're in the end run. So I thought it was the same thing. Dave?
Yeah, well, I think palliative care to me is connotations of, yeah, non-curative, and we're not going to make this better, but let's make it as comfortable and as pleasant as possible for owners and patients all round. And connotations of, yeah, chronic pain management, chronic cancer therapy. Like a lot of my medicine specialty, I deal with a lot of oncology patients and a lot of clients, or either untreatable cancers or owners choose not to do conventional chemo. So they'll do sort of low grade metronomic chemo that's pretty well tolerated and just keeps them comfortable and keeps the cancer at bay for a little while, but with not necessarily a curative intent.
Yeah. And I mean, that's truly hospice care or palliative care. I mean, we palliate disease all the time. We palliate the flu. You don't cure the flu. You palliate it till you feel better. Yeah. Or you could have a patient or a human that has cancer that you can cure or go into remission, but you still can have a palliative care team come in and help better manage those symptoms, where the oncologist is really focused on, let's treat the disease. Let's treat this cancer. Let's provide this X, Y, and Z therapy for this cancer, where a palliative care team can come in and be, all right, you're experiencing nausea, or you have pain from this type of cancer, okay, or such. So it can be curative or non-curative, which is palliative care. Hospice is generally geared towards non-curative disease and the end stage of it. But one of the things that is just what I hear all the time, when at least here in the States, is, oh, my patient needs hospice care, palliative care. It translates both from veterinarians and clients of, oh, I was referred to you for hospice care because my pet has 3 days to live and there's nothing else we can do. So it's almost synonymous with impending death, which I would just love to change that perception and misconception, because there's so much we can do with palliative care and hospice care, and patients oftentimes, just like in human medicine, live way beyond expectations because we're managing the whole body, the whole pet, and doing a better job at it.
So is it fair to say, Shay, that in your definition of palliative care, it's anything that looks at patient comfort, it looks at the whole patient, that's not necessarily associated with the curing or the treatment of the disease? So it could be for any disease that we are I'm trying to think, me and Dave talked about IMHA, immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, right at the start of the clinical podcast. And the treatment there is the immunosuppressives, right? So that's the real thing. But then there's all the stuff surrounding it, the side effects of the medication or the discomfort. So palliative care per definition is all the stuff that's not it's not the fix, but it's let's get you through this in as comfortable a way as possible, whether this being a treatment for a curable disease or this being the thing that is going to be the end of you. Does that make sense?
100%. Yeah, that's a great reframe of it. And it extends to just a philosophy of palliative care or hospice care. It extends to the family and it becomes that collaborative care. So not just the doctor saying we should do X, Y, and Z and here's the treatment plan, but collaborating with the pet owner and what makes sense for what you can do, what makes sense for what your pet will receive, bringing in the other patient in the room, so to speak, to make sure goals are aligned and to make sure that what's recommended is actually makes sense from a quality of life perspective. Yeah, I think vets too are just trained to do the perfect medicine. Like you have this disease and here's the perfect way to treat that disease. But palliative care, I think, is less like that. And it's that gray zone of medicine. It's that art of medicine. And so instead of this might be the standard of care, but what makes sense for this patient in this situation and asking yourself, well, why couldn't we do this? And really making those medical recommendations, not just to treat disease, but equally focusing on making those medical recommendations to treat quality of life. And I think that's a big differentiator between just practicing medicine and actually practicing palliative care. It's a framework of medicine that provides comfort and focuses on comfort.
And how can you tell us how the difference in this field between humans and the veterinary field? Like obviously humans don't have the euthanasia option, so how does that affect end stage management of, well, life stage management?
That is the main differentiator. There's some states in the United States where you can have physician assisted euthanasia, but for the most part that's not accepted. And for pets, when we get to that point where there's no longer quality of life, despite what palliative measures you can provide to improve that quality of life, and that's usually when we begin to shift towards those end of life decisions. But there's so much we can do to keep pets comfortable for such a long time if we have the time and space to actually do it. And I think taking the concept of an oncologist, you have all these patients that come in through the door. You have an hour of time with them at the most. It's usually, here's the disease, here's the treatment plan, here's what it's cost, here's your options, any questions. And there's so much information overload. Clients walk away not really knowing what to do. And a lot of balls get dropped, not because the veterinary team's doing a poor job, it's because the system doesn't work and the way we approach care doesn't work. The perfect example is, you know, a patient with osteosarcoma, which we see all the time for palliative care and hospice care, is most patients that come to us, they're coming to hospice, translation, they're coming to get euthanized any day now because they have osteosarcoma. Then when you look at the treatment plan or what's actually happening, the pain management part of it is subpar, not because the veterinarian doesn't know how to treat pain. There's just this gap in care where you can't manage all of these patients as an oncologist and really have that one-on-one time. And it's like, boy, you implement these multimodal pain management plans with a really strategic pain plan and pets feel great and they continue to do great for several more months, 6 months, 7 months. And then that family has that time to really wrap their head around the diagnosis and really making sure that end of life journey is what they want for themselves and for their pet. And you can really manage comfort incredibly well, but you don't have the time to do that in that rapid clinical setting. And the follow-up. Clients don't call back saying, oh, I stopped this gabapentin because it made my pet wobbly, you know, and then they don't hear the fact that your pet's going to be wobbly for a few days at these doses because that's what gabapentin does. So there's just this disconnect. And the same thing, God, I worked as a nurse for almost a decade in human medicine, and you see the same things. So that was part of the journey, was like, boy, what's broken is the time component. Veterinarians are doing a great job. They just don't have the time to do it well. And clients need support and they're not getting it. And when I started the hospice practice, I said, I'm going to start offering 3-hour appointments. That was literally what I led with. And people, the practice owners, they were like, there's no way you can make that a financially sustainable model. You know, I'm going into my 11th year of doing this, spreading this nationwide in specialty hospitals, and it's a sustainable model. So provide value and do it well.
And you're eating more than cauliflowers, like you're having balanced meals and...
That's right.
Some protein.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that's amazing, Shane.
Quick interruption for a bit of housekeeping. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, man, I'd love to learn more from Shay, then the conference that we keep referring to is in Wanaka in New Zealand from the 14th to the 18th of August. So that's 2023 in case you're listening to this way in the future. Wanaka is a magical place in a magical country. And in August, the conference venue should be surrounded by snowy mountains and long ski runs. So outside of learning about palliative care and oncology and a whole bunch of other stuff, we'll also be doing a lot of snow stuff and a fair bit of socializing. So if you can at all, come and join us. There are still tickets available. The details are at vetsontour.com.au or click the link in the show description. We'll be doing some live recording sessions at the conference that we'll share over on the clinical podcasts. So if you can't join us in the snow, but you are keen to get practical on this stuff, then join our Vet Vault nerds for a drip feed of, can I say this about my own product? Really, really good clinical content. I'm still posting some amazing stuff that I recorded at the last conference I attended with superstar speakers from the land of ECC like Dr. Corin Boyd and the one and only Professor Kate Hopper. Yes, the one from your textbook. Those are all live at vvn.supercast.com. Your first 2 weeks are free. Okay, back to Shay.
It's a bit eye-opening. I'm fascinated by the shift that you made from emergency, because I've been working in emergency critical care for the last decade or so, and the fact that you had the desire to shift from emergency into this, which at first glance, it feels like two worlds apart, right? Because emergency is that, all right, we've got many things to deal with and it's life and death and we don't have time for the warm fuzzies, just get shit done and then let somebody else can worry about the repercussions of it. But yet, having said that, you do bump into this all the time in emergency. The stuff that comes in, suddenly the old dog that suddenly crashes or the animal that's this, and you have to deal with it all the time. And it's often that decision of, well, there's a sudden crisis, I want to put out the fire, and then that letting them go and saying, well, I don't have time to go through an hour consult of all the things that we can do, but I'm going to send you back to your regular vet and cross my fingers that they'll do a good job at this. But a little bit of your head, a bit of your mind's going, fuck, I hope this animal is going to get the care that it needs. Was that the impetus? Was that the drive for you to start this center?
Oh, yes. And this starts to get me very excited internally and ramped up. And there's three big points where my brain went with just that, the comment. One was they go back to their veterinarian, and at least in the States, the average FaceTime a client has with their veterinarian a year is 16 minutes.
A year.
So a veterinarian to do a good job with this complex disease that was punted from the ER back to the regular vet is really tough on that regular vet. That's one big thing. The other big thing, and this is what I would really love to also change, is when I started this practice, this hospice practice, I continued to do ER on the weekends and then palliative care Monday through Friday. And so I spent 2 years straddling both sides. And it really was such an eye-opener for me, because as an emergency vet, hemangiosarcoma comes in hemoabdomen, surgery, euthanasia. That's your typical two ways to go.
I lived yesterday. My shift yesterday morning, I had exactly that case.
Yeah, right. And, but But there's a third option, and that third option is palliative care and sending that pet home with a comfort kit, or I call it a comfort kit, but just injectable pain medication and sedation. Let them recover at home from that bleed and see what happens. Euthanasia is permanent. They're going to die anyways if you go that route. But if you can guide them through a palliative care option, if they can't or don't want to do surgery, our average hemangiosarcoma patients, when we look back of our 10-year patients, hemoabdomens that come to us in hospice, the average lifespan is 4 months, which is the same as if we would have done surgery, and way longer than if we would have euthanized in the emergency room when clients don't even have an option to think about it, because it's such a gut shot diagnosis, and it feels very urgent in the moment to actually make this decision. And there's so many disease processes and situations that when I was straddling those two things in the ER, I would be like, okay, well, we can move to hospice/palliative care tomorrow. Let me come see you. And the most amazing outcomes happen. Not every case. Sometimes I go and euthanasia happens several days later. But I mean, I can tell you literally hundreds of stories of just, wow, didn't expect that. Wasn't seeing that coming. I had a patient with an invasive adrenal tumor that went into the vena cava, that came in with bleeding, shocky, non-surgical. We went through an ultrasound. We stabilized him, sent him home. I was going to their home for euthanasia that next morning. Showed up, dog's wagging his tail, super happy. And the owner is like, I know he's got really bad disease and you're here to euthanize him, but how can I euthanize him when he looks like this? I know he's going to get bad again. I'm like, we don't have to. A year and a half later is when we euthanized him. It's just like crazy stuff. And if we take that third option away, you know, the alternative is death. So why not go into that gray zone of medicine and be that collaborative partner with that pet parent and offer them options and get a little bit outside the comfort zone of that perfect medicine? God, the internist would always give me shit. Like, you can't send that patient home on oxygen and then blah, 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 blah. I'm like, why not? You can't give the clients injectable Lasix to give at home if they get into a crisis. Why not? We're gonna euthanize. So it's just thinking about things differently. So that's point number two. Point number three. ER vets are where they go out to pasture is hospice and palliative care. I see it all the time. And that's like the running joke is when we had 20 vets in our practice before we ended up expanding, and most of them were ER vets and they were doing this either full time or on the side. But the joke is where hospice is where ER vets go out to pasture. There is this synergy between hospice, palliative care, and ER medicine. And I've been trying to understand this for over a decade. And I think it's that fast pace, it's emotional, it's short-lived relationships, it's doing something, doing a really good job, and you know, the next thing. That's part of my theory, but I'm still working through that one. But anyways, I'll take a pause. I start to get very excited about this.
I love it. I love your passion, Che, and yeah, it's really eye-opening, the shift from ER to hospice. So I was just wondering that's really interesting about hemangiosarcoma in particular. A number of my cases have surprised me just going home on antifibrinolytics and just to try and prevent bleeds becoming severe bleeds. But is there any published information on sort of survival times and things that would really surprise people?
That is on the list of 1,000 things to do. You know, having all this data and trying to compose it into retrospective studies and connecting with other, trying to create this network of other hospice providers across not just the US, but internationally, and begin collecting this information, begin doing things that perfect medicine doesn't really allow, like stage 3 iris kidney disease cats, give them Medicam if they have arthritis. You know, all these things that we're not supposed to do in perfect medicine. If we could begin these studies with showing the outcome and the improvement in quality of life, that's amazing. I don't hesitate to do to do anything to that effect, balancing that quality versus quantity. And again, you just are always surprised at the outcome, but just need more time, more resources, more me's to pull this together. But so short answer, no. Long answer is like, man, that, and I would love to do something like that.
Following up from your previous discussion, Shay, this might be a controversial question, but do you think that us in the profession are, and obviously not always, but are too quick to euthanize? You talk about the Himanjasar case, but there's many others where we just go, no, it's not going to do well. Let's just kill it.
I do. And it's because I see that. And I think it's multiple fold. As veterinarians, we're empaths. Our number one role is to make sure there's no suffering, and perception is reality. Like if we see something, well, what really defines suffering? A classic example is as a veterinarian, you get such a small snapshot into the life of this pet and this family. And so I had a patient, Jacob, that saw one of our oncologists, and he had this big old nasty, gnarly, stinky tumor on his mouth. It was a squamous cell tumor. And everyone was like, this pet needs to be euthanized, and this pet needs to be, how could this owner let this happen? And it's like, so she came, she was referred to me. It was an oncologist from a different specialty group, showed up at that home. That cat with this nasty, stinky, gross tumor was in and out of my bag, looking for treats, rubbing up against my pant leg, super happy, eating. And the family, the mom, the pet mom was so conflicted. She's like, I'm being told I need to do this, but this is what I'm seeing. And the veterinary teams, they, with that snapshot in time, they don't see the home. They don't see the interaction. They don't see the bigger picture. And so decisions are being made on disease and how it looks, not on that unit, the patient and the family. And it's not a wrong thing, but we're just not trained to think about things that way. Again, it goes back to that perfect medicine. You have this, we have to do that. And I don't know, other than just raising awareness and sharing stories and such, any other way to change it. But I always say treat the patient, not the disease. And I think as veterinarians, we are so protective of trying not to get anywhere near suffering that we often euthanize early, which isn't bad either, but
it's suffering. But it's also, there's a weird thing in our profession that it's been a bugbear of mine for the last 10 years, is that we have this thing that if something dies without us euthanizing it, if it dies without me, then I've failed. Then it's something, you know, I've got to kill you before you die. That it's this weird obsession that it's a failure. where I don't know, I say to my teammates, and I've said to clients before, look, I'm going to die unassisted. Something's going to happen. I'm going to suffer.
Yes.
And hopefully not too much. Hopefully I'll have somebody taking care of me like you do. But eventually I'm going to go. So why are we in such a rush to say, well, so again, that I had this exact conversation with my Himanjasar patient yesterday, because for years I've been saying, or take them home, option three. Owners come in to euthanize that dog that I've been stabilizing for the past 6 hours, and it looks fine. I'm like, well, how can I kill you? You look absolutely fine. So then I started sending them home and saying that to owners, saying, oh, we can send them home, but with the proviso that you understand there is a risk that there's going to be a catastrophic fatal bleed at home one day. You're going to come home from work and he might be dead on the lawn. If you're okay with that, and then I'll say to them, but whether that happens or whether I kill him, he's going to be equally as dead. And getting people to have that mindset is really hard for our profession. Do you find that we struggle with that?
Yeah, 100%. And we're not taught to think about it that way. It's so curative driven and so perfect medicine driven and so avoid suffering at all costs. But to your point, we all pretty much die unassisted, meaning without euthanasia. And the important part is when you get to that point, we have the ability, just like in human medicine, to palliate that. We can do palliative sedation. We can do increasing pain medications and pain management. until that time of euthanasia. But sometimes people just need an extra day. And when you coerce someone into, or making them feel pressured into a euthanasia that they're not ready for, the pet may be ready, but boy, if that client's not ready, that is going to leave lasting brain damage and regret and all sorts of negative consequences for the rest of their life. And it's like, boy, if you can support both of those patients, palliate one, get that family to where they're comfortable with that decision, that's the magic, that's the win, that's the serving both patients. We always have two patients in hospice or palliative care more than any other time. Mm.
Dave?
That's a really good point about the euthanasia and us feeling like we have to intervene. I guess my biggest fear is that the animal's going to be in pain and there's going to be suffering if it's not supervised or if we don't take care of it, but maybe that's misguided. I was just going to comment that I feel like maybe there's regional attitudes, difference in attitudes towards euthanasia. I'm not sure what things are like in Southern California versus Australia, but I often find I'm trying to convince owners that they don't need to euthanize their pets, that there's good management options for CKD or various cancers, and yet some owners have sort of got a farmer's mentality that, oh, it's just a dog, it's just a cat, and it's got terminal disease, what are we doing? So, and even when I'm convincing them that we've got some good, long quality of life ahead, it's sometimes I find it hard to talk them out of euthanasia, which is, it's got to be their decision, but I find that's a battle sometimes.
Yeah, the 180 battle, the reverse of that, and that's something that's a really interesting perspective and something I don't often see, obviously, from what I do. But yeah, I'm just in thinking, gosh, what would I do? I would almost rather have that than the opposite. But
yeah, well, I mean, I guess our role is the patient advocate, and all I can do is present the case of the disease and the quality of life, and it's their decision ultimately.
There's definitely an attitude like that in Australia, and South Africa is the same. I do find that sometimes those people are more open to conversation than you first give them credit. I've got friends like that who have animals who go, yeah, we talk about the stuff I do and they go, oh, that's ridiculous, I'd never spend that much. When it comes to it, I'll just smack him on the head with a shovel. But that's big talk. And then I always tease him. I say, yeah, we'll see. I'll see you in my consult room one day when we're having this conversation and you'll be in tears crying about your little dog. And then we'll talk about plans. Wait until the heart kicks in when it actually happens, and then you won't be so tough. That is a tough one, Dave. And that's quite common in emergency and critical care as well, where you get a patient present for euthanasia and you've never seen them and you don't know the background and you've, and it's old and let's say it's got really bad arthritis and it can't get up out of bed and they go, it's time. And then you discuss it with them and you say, well, what painkillers is he on? No, nothing. It's a tough conversation because almost emotionally, once people make that decision, they're there. They've spent the week thinking about it and they're emotionally at the place where they're ready to let go and then to intervene. It's always very sensitive for me to go, well, I don't want to change your mind and then we try something and it doesn't work and then you have to be back here next week and you've gone through this extra week of anguish thinking about should I, shouldn't I? But I can't not say it. I can't not say, look, before we do this, exactly as you said, Shay, this is final. Once we've euthanized and we're done, there's no going back from that. There are a bunch of new things that we can try. I've seen some of these dogs or cats with kidney failure or something do really well. So there are things, but no pressure. If you are, I know I'll always finish by saying, if you are ready and if you're at the place where you feel it's time to let go, no judgment at all, but there are options to discuss if you're open to it. And then often people will say, okay, well, let's talk about it. That does help. The opposite end of the scale, say, there's a third option. So now we've talked about two things. There's a third one. We'll have people listening to this going, yeah, but we've all seen that patient where the owner's gone too far, where we've dragged it out too long, and they've actually, where you start getting that concern, well, is this patient actually suffering? Is it worthwhile doing to it what we're doing to it? Or I've had clients come in saying, yeah, I regret the last month. I should have let it go a month ago. because this last month was just unpleasant for both of us. How do you find that balance? How do you guide veterinarians or clients to make that decision to say, okay, well, we've done what we can. This is too much. What are your measures for drawing a line under a pet's life?
Yeah, I think one tool that I find very helpful is, and that's the importance of really carving out this time to explore goals and lines in the sand, so to speak. And one of the things that during our initial consult is, what do you want for your pet? What don't you want for your pet? And really creating those lines in the sand and sharing that what we say today, what tends to happen is, I don't want this for my pet. Here's the line in the sand. And then a month goes by and all of a sudden we're at that line and they're like, erase, erase, erase. And the line gets moved, and the new abnormal becomes the new normal, and you just keep moving forward like that. So addressing these things early and creating these anchor points, here's what we talked about, what you didn't want, and just, you know, clear as kind. When you get to that point, it's like, hey, here's what you didn't want. I'm seeing this. You are probably not seeing this because it has become your new normal, like we talked about 2 months ago. As your advocate and the person you entrusted to ensure that we didn't cross these lines in the sand, I'm bringing this up because I'm seeing this. And having these predetermined points of or lines in the sand, I think is really helpful for families, so that when they do get there, you can go back to that. And it's something that you mutually agreed upon or discussed at the time. So it's not like you're saying, hey, your pet's now suffering. It's reframing it. Here's where you didn't want your pet to get, as we talked about 2 months ago, and now we're here. I'm here to be your eyes when you can't always see. And I find that really helpful. And it's like such a tangled mess, really, when you get into the ethics and the morals of too far, what's suffering, who defines it. All we can do is the best we can do and work to be that advocate for the pet and for the client. You always have to be an advocate for both. And having conversations early so that you can help as you move forward.
Okay, that helps.
And do you find it helpful to use pain scores or quality of life scores or things like that to help in the process, given everything's so subjective otherwise?
And I developed a pain scale just because there wasn't one out there that really fit the home setting. So all the pain scales that we used didn't quite equate to the language of pain, as I would call it. So yes, we use pain scales, and it's the one we use is framed on the clinical signs that clients see in the home that would indicate discomfort. So it's really home-based signs that clients would see, like trouble going up and down the stairs, you know, doing the Elvis leg shake as they're trying to go to the bathroom, all of these signs for discomfort. And quality of life scales, boy, there's a lot of them out there, and I like to just share with clients, here's all the tools that we have currently at our disposal. Each one has their own shortcomings and each one has their own really good strengths. What one resonates with you? And what I find is that resonates the best for people is creating their own custom quality of life scale, so to speak. So when we're in a hospice appointment, it's like, think back to 6 months before your pet had this illness or this disease or was acting this way. What were the five things that made his day great? What would give him a rating of 10 for these days? And then we list those individual markers for that pet, because it's different for every pet. For some pets, it's bringing a ball to the door every single time the owner comes home. For other pets, it's, you know, wanting to walk 40 feet ahead of them when they go out on their daily hike. So really fine tuning it to that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's like, all right, think back to the worst day. Think back to a 0 day, a 1 or 2 out of 10 day. What did that look like to you? oh gosh, he was doing this behavior, or he didn't want to eat at all his favorite treat. It becomes individualized. So the client makes a list of all of the awesome things. The client makes a list of all of the negative things on their best day and worst day. And then we sort of backfill in, all right, well, if this is a 10 and this is a 0, what would make a 5? And so we create this gradation. And then that helps them customize it to their own pet's likes and joys and normal behaviors, as opposed to a scale that is more not as specific to that pet, or that doesn't have weighted things. There's great quality of life scales out there, but if you can't breathe and if you hurt, I don't care how good your hygiene is and how well you can get around, like, quality is not there. So it's really understanding the teaching clients the weight of individual things as well when it comes to quality of life.
That's really interesting, Shay. I love the customizing it to the home environment. And you're spot on in the five minutes or more that we spend with a client talking about the pet's life at home doesn't begin to describe their normal behavior. And I've got a 14-year-old dog next to me now that isn't in hospice just yet, but he's got some issues, one of which is he's just been diagnosed with Cushing's, and his whole personality has been consumed by a voracious one-track mind about food, and he's just been an absolute pain in the neck and staring us in the face every time we're eating. He licks his bowl clean like 5 times even after he's just consumed his meal, and we've just started treating him, and he's just started doing some of the behaviors that we've forgotten about. Like, we get home and he starts his full woo woo woo, which we literally haven't heard for ages because he'd just stare at us wanting his meal as soon as we get home. So translating that to sort of quality of life measures and in the home environment is fascinating.
And it's not validated, it's not scientific, but it's relatable.
Pretty hard to standardize.
As you can see, so.
And tell me, you've sort of enlightened us with a few things from your career at the moment. What are the few things that you would sort of tell veterinarians interested in this field to sort of find out more, or what do you think would sort of wow them and inspire them to find out more, or even start the journey into becoming a hospice vet?
Yeah, there are a lot of resources, and here I can share those resources. The IAAHPC is a hospice organization that I was a really integral part of for a long time. It's where you go to learn if you want to become involved in that community. So that's a great resource. And the other thing too is, it's when we hire someone, we expand and a veterinarian comes to us, there seems to be this mysticism around hospice and palliative care. Like, oh my God, I don't know how to treat this pet because blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's doing the same thing that you're doing, but without actually the pressure, because what's the alternative, right? You're providing palliation, you're providing symptom management. So to me, it's less about how to do something as it is changing your mindset in what you do, letting go of, again, of that perfect medicine, or, you know, everyone's doing palliative care, every veterinarian's doing hospice care. But it's taking it to that next step where it's ask why not? What would I do if it were my pet? Why couldn't I dispense an NSAID without blood work once a year when the alternative is euthanasia or discomfort? It really is an emerging career. I don't know about where you guys are, but it's almost becoming also like a gig economy here, where people are getting out of clinical practice and I'm going to start an in-home euthanasia practice, or I'm going to start a hospice practice.
Yeah.
So I think I went really sideways with the question you were asking about resources. IAHPC.org is one of them, and I can provide more. CADA is another great, the Companion Animal Euthanasia Training Academy by Kathy Cooney. It's another great resource for all things end of life and hospice.
I liked where you were going with it, rather than just the resources, rather than the how. I'd love to find out more about this as a career option, a couple of things of what it's like to work in this. My first question is it super satisfying, or does it get a bit depressing because you are often working with the end of life? Does it wear you down, or does it build you up?
It fills the cup. And it is such a unique niche in medicine. And, you know, when you think about the emergency room, you get great clients, and then you get clients that are like, oh my God, you did all these tests and you couldn't tell me what was wrong with my pen. And I spent $5,000 and I still don't know what's going on. And you went over the estimate by $2. And, you know, you get this population of clients. At end of life in hospice and palliative care, it's like selected for all the best clients. They're just so grateful that you're there. They're so grateful that you spent the time. They're so grateful that you created this experience for them that they wanted. And so even though it's sad and, you know, you're dealing with end of life issues, you guys have been in ER. Who do you get the most thank you cards from? The pets that you've euthanized or had a good death with. So imagine a career where you get all the thank you cards and love mail and none of the, you went $2 over my estimate and still couldn't figure out what was wrong with my pet. So, but it's also, you know, are you wired that way? It's very fulfilling. And I think ER vets are wired that way, but just like people are born to be surgeons, there's people who are born to provide this care. So it's not for everyone, but boy, if it's for you and it's something you resonate with, the satisfaction you get despite what you're doing is incredible. I think I've done 3 spays in my life and I wanted to vomit every time I did it because I was sure I sewed something up wrong or didn't do something. Like that was anxiety all day long for me. Ending a life well, doing palliative care, it's like, huh, wow, look what I did. So I think it's personality dependent also.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I imagine clients must be so grateful to everything you do, and certainly the oncologists that I've worked with get more chocolates and flowers than anyone I've ever seen because people are so, so grateful for what they do.
100%.
Can I ask a practical question, Dave, before we move on? So for somebody who's listening to this going, yeah, that, hey, two types of people listening to this. The one is the general practitioner or the practice owner who goes, all right, this resonates. I think we should be better at this. How do I make it practical though? Because you talk about time and energy. It does take time. The reason we don't do it is because we have 20-minute consults or 10-minute consults and it doesn't. So how do we make this practical for practices? And the follow-up or part of that question, I think, is the exact resistance that you had at the start where they said, well, how the hell do you make a 3-hour consult financially viable? How do you make it financially viable?
Yes. So 2 big broad stroke answers is engage your nurses, a nurse-driven model. That's what makes it work. And telehealth, really implementing telehealth. And if you go, okay, here comes a shameless plug to the Vets on Tour, there will be 2 hours on just the how to do this, how to integrate this into your practice, how do you make it. And it really is that 75% of hospice palliative care is non-medical. So slice that 75% off, teach your nurses how to do that, engage your nurses, elevate their license, and then the doctor can drive the medicine. You know, here's what we need to do to palliate these symptoms, but we have a virtual nursing department and our nurses are all across the United States and they manage all of our palliative care patients. So you can, there's so many creative ways to provide really high touch care through nurses and through tapping into resources that don't necessarily have to be right there in your brick and mortar building. It's another area that gets me really excited.
Yeah, I'm super excited to hear about it in Wanaka. And yeah, I mean, nurse-driven models, I think with a lot of our practices, nurses could be and want to be doing so much more, and they're amazing people to work with and can make it really successful.
I feel like this might be a rabbit hole.
Yeah, no, go. I love rabbit holes.
it might be too deep a rabbit hole, but the telehealth aspect of your answer fascinates me because I feel like from what we've discussed so far, a lot of the palliative care stuff is very compassion-based, right? Heart-based, relationship-based. So my default goes, but it's got to be face-to-face. I have to, we have to feel each other, not just sit on the end of a computer screen and go, tick, 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 well, there's the drugs. There's your drugs for the week. Does the telehealth tick that box well enough?
It does. And there are ways to be very engaged virtually. I really heavily went into telemedicine in 2015, and it is definitely an area of passion of mine and trying to engage that more. But the beautiful thing is we're managing symptoms, so we don't have to touch and feel the pet. We generally know a diagnosis, or the clients don't want to get to a diagnosis. So we can manage 95% of what's going on by just history and understanding. So here in the United States, we actually have to touch, in California, we have to touch a pet to establish the VCPR. But once we have that initial, so our nurses do an hour and a half intake. It's a virtual intake. They go through all of the questions and history and goals and all of the things that are non-medical. Our doctor goes to the home for an hour, 40-minute part of the medical part, does their physical exam, discusses the medical plan. And then from that point forward, everything is done via telemedicine. Clients don't have to schlep their pet back into the hospital. We don't have to drive back to the home. Everyone's happy. They have this team available to them 7 days a week. It's phenomenal. And it's what makes things cost effective for everybody. It's a really, yeah.
Okay. Wow. I think come to Wanaka. Up until now, I was just excited for the snowboarding, Dave, but that's changed. Now I'm actually really excited for the sessions as well.
Yeah, that's exciting, isn't it? Yeah, so I know we've got a few people sort of doing a bit of what you do in Australia, Shay, but yeah, it sounds like developing it the way that you have. I'm fascinated to hear more about it.
Yeah, and Hugh, if you're going to be there, obviously conversations can continue, and happy to share everything, but also really happy to evolve just in an organic way with what the people who are there want to hear. So if they'd rather hear more about how do I make this work in a practice over how to manage squamous cell carcinoma, it's like, let's go that route.
Yeah. What about some live podcasting, Dave? Should we do a live podcast session?
Absolutely.
Should we involve the audience? Dave, have you got more stuff, or should we start wrapping?
Oh, no, I'm happy to wrap it up, and yeah, can't wait to listen and meet Shay in person.
Yeah, Shay, this has been really cool. I love conversations like this where suddenly a new part of my brain opens up and I go, oh, wow, like 20 years in the profession and suddenly a light bulb goes off and there's a whole new thing to explore. And I hope it's the same. I think there will be a lot of people listening to this who feel the same. Let's wrap up with getting a little bit more personal, back away from the palliative care and back to Shay. Podcasts. Are you a podcast listener?
I am. I am an audiobook addict and podcast listener.
So what should be on my playlist for the weekend ahead?
So I like podcasts that are focused on marketing, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. So two of my favorite podcasts are Business Made Simple, and it's a podcast by Donald Miller, and also Online Marketing Made Easy, which is a podcast by Amy Porterfield. And what I love about them is it's about anything we do in life is about crafting a story, right? It's veterinary medicine. You are a veterinarian, but you have to craft your story. You have to sell what you're doing, whether you're a practice owner or you're in the exam room trying to get an estimate approved for X treatment. But it really helps to frame, how do you create clarity around what it is you want to say? And how do you create story and interest that people will want to engage in your conversations? So I think these are, although they're marketing and business podcasts, they really extend skills into a lot of different areas, whether you own a business or do marketing or you don't.
Great. I love marketing stuff. So that's good. That's definitely going on the list. Now, the pass along question. I'm sloppy with it because I forget what the last people asked, but I get the guest to ask the question that we want to ask of the next guest on the podcast. So the one that I've got for you from one of our previous guests is, do you feel like our profession, like the veterinary profession, is becoming a part-time profession?
That's a very interesting question. And I have to look at it from kind of a macro lens and a micro lens. I think as a profession as a whole, no, because there's so many facets to our profession, whether it's research or education or pharma or you name it. If we bring the lens into just clinical practice, I would say yes, the complete opposite. I think we are becoming a part-time profession, and I wouldn't go so far as a gig economy, but at least what I'm seeing is, as a relief vet, you get more autonomy and you get paid more than as a full-time veterinarian. We also have this demographic of women who want to raise families, and they, not to be sexist, but they're usually the primary caregiver. And so a part-time role makes the most sense for them. Then there's work-life balance, where 5 days a week, 4 days a week is often too much for people, given it's not an easy job. So given the intensity of the days that you work, less days are often a better balance between. It's why so many people come to hospice. We have ER vets. They're like, what? I'm going to do 6 ER shifts a month and 6 hospice shifts a month because it gives a better balance. And also I think the burnout level that's happening is causing people to pull back a little bit, where they, I can do 3 days, but I can't do 4 days, or I can do 2 days. So I do think in clinical practice, that is a trend. Profession as a whole, less so.
Your question for my next guest, not knowing who the next guest will be.
Yes, I'm glad that I saw that. This is just a nut. There's so many nuts you want to try and crack and try and figure out. But trends I'm seeing are veterinarians and veterinary teams are needing to work less and get paid more. Like salaries, at least in, again, my lens is from the United States, but the profession is demanding a higher wage, rightly so. Pet parents are demanding lower cost of care and higher value with that lower cost of care. And so there's this chasm that's happening between the two, and it's not something that can keep going the way it's going. So how do we solve for that problem? Telehealth, pet insurance, you know, these are all things that are possible pieces of the solution, but they're not gaining traction. And my fear is things are going to crack before we get to these solutions. So what can we do as a profession to bridge that gap? What happens if we have this implosion? What do we do about it? There's a big disconnect that's happening. And especially with this millennial, they want more. They want more education. They want more time. And that costs more money. It's just a big gap.
If I have a guest on that can answer that question, that'd be quite an extraordinary guest. I'm going to ask it and see their face. They'll just be like, but it's a very good question.
These are the things that keep me up at night.
They'll probably be able to solve a lot of the world's problems if they can solve that
next
one.
Exactly. Next question. Well, we've solved that one. Climate change next. What's the solution?
Sort that out.
It's a very real problem, and we're living it right now. What are we going to do about it? Yeah. How do we address it? Like, it's, you can't have both at the same time, but we do.
Yeah. Right. The last wrap-up question, Shay, is, you are at a conference somewhere and you have the opportunity to speak to all of the veterinary new grads of, where are we now, 2023. And you have a couple of minutes to give them one little bit of advice. What's your bit of advice for them?
My bit of advice is, life is too short to live in mediocrity. It is. It's just too short. If you are not happy doing what you're doing, change it. If you're not happy in your situation, change it. Don't compromise. You can compromise. Life is always a compromise in one way or the other. But if you find yourself feeling stuck, getting stuck, don't settle. And I think so many people get into these ruts. And just like we talked about lines in the sand, you know, the new abnormal mm-hmm. becomes the new normal. And then pretty soon they wake up and they're like, what happened to these last 5 years? So maybe we need quality of life scales for ourselves, right? Where we, like, this is what makes a 10 day for me. And this is what makes a 0 day for me. And when we start getting towards that, recognize it, but just really, yeah, life's too short for mediocrity. So don't fall into that rut.
I love that. That's really cool.
All right. We will see you on the slopes. Dave, Shay, thank you so much for expanding our minds and opening up a whole new rabbit hole. We will have to have you back on some of the clinical stuff to dig into some of the nitty gritty of how do we do this? Because now I want to do it, but I want to get better at it. I don't want to be mediocre. Thank you so much for your time. And Dave, thank you for the intro and for bringing us an awesome guest. And have a lovely day.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Shay. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
I want to share an email from one of our clinical podcast subscribers with you. It's edited lightly to take out some personal details, but I love it because it demonstrates something that I've learned over the last couple of years. That continued professional growth is an integral part of personal growth. So here goes. I wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you've been doing with the podcast. I can honestly say that you have genuinely saved my career. No exaggeration. I came back from my third maternity leave, a tired and confused vet, senior in age, but not confidence, straight into an emergency job. To say that it was a steep learning curve is an understatement. Dealing with the guilt of leaving my 8-month-old and my 2 other young children in childcare and working long shifts with varying levels of support honestly nearly pushed me into giving it all up. But the podcast allowed me to revise knowledge that was buried in my brain very deeply at times and become current again. It honestly gave me so much more confidence. Fast forward a year, and I'm proud to say that I'm mostly thriving as an emergency vet and still learning loads. If that resonates with you, then we would love you as a part of our community of Vet Vault nerds. Join us at vvn.supercast.com.